welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today I'm in a devilish mood. We're set to explore gothic horror, so cue eerie organ music. Okay, maybe not. Fantastic fiction, disturbing, mesmerizing, twisted thrillers. Fear not. Today's titles will not feature the likes of Freddy Krueger and the Slasher Gang. Our program goes the literary route, captivating classics and new titles that dwell on the darker side. Today, I'm honored to speak with Joyce Carol Oates about her new book, The Accursed. Famous historical figures populate her pages, including Woodrow Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, Upton Sinclair, Jack London, and, oh yes, an elusive shapeshifter who might be the devil or not. So stay with us on this journey of fear and fantasy as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Wood Mode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Hill has been called Stephen King's literary son. They've even written books together. If, like me, you'd been unaware of his work, it's time for the book report to make the introductions. In NOS 4A2, we meet Victoria McQueen, a kid known for her uncanny knack for finding things. A misplaced bracelet, a missing photograph, answers to unanswerable questions. Charles Talent Manx has a gift of his own. He likes to take children for rides in his 1938 Rolls-Royce with the vanity plate NOS 4A2. In the Rolls, he and his innocent guests can slip out of the everyday world and onto hidden roads that lead to an astonishing playground he calls Christmasland. Mile by mile, the journey across Charlie's twisted imagination transforms his precious passengers, leaving them as terrifying and unstoppable as their benefactor. And then one day, Victoria finds her way, inevitably, to Charlie. But that was a lifetime ago. Now Victoria, the only kid ever to escape Charlie's evil, is grown up and desperate to forget. But Charlie hasn't stopped thinking about the one that got away. Kate Mulgrew narrates.
The brat was 8 years old the first time she rode over the covered bridge that crossed the distance between lost and found. It happened like this. They were only just back from the lake, and the brat was in her bedroom, putting up a poster of David Hasselhoff. Black leather jacket, grinning in that way that made dimples in his cheeks, standing with his arms crossed in front of Kit, when she heard a sobbing cry of shock in her parents' bedroom. The brat had one foot up on the headboard of her bed and was holding the poster to the wall with her chest while she pinned down the corners with brown tape. She froze, tilted her head to listen, not with any alarm, just wondering what her mother was worked up about now. It sounded like she had lost something. "Had it! I know I had it!" she cried. "You think you took it off down by the water before you went in the lake?" asked Chris McQueen. "Yesterday afternoon? I told you already I didn't go swimming. But maybe you took it off when you put on suntan lotion." They continued to go back and forth along these lines, but the brat decided for the time being that she could tune them out. At the age of 8, the brat, Victoria to her second grade teacher, Vicky to her mother, but the brat to her father and in her heart, was well beyond being alarmed by her mother's outbursts. Linda McQueen's gales of laughter and overwrought cries of disappointment were the soundtrack of the Bratz' everyday life and were only occasionally worth noticing. She smoothed the poster flat, finished taping it, and stepped back to admire it. David Hasselhoff. So cool. She was frowning, trying to decide if it was crooked, when she heard a door slam and another anguished cry, her mother again, and then her father's voice. "Didn't I know we were headed here?" he said. "Right on cue." "I asked if you checked the bathroom, and you said you did. You said you had everything. Did you check the bathroom or not?" "I don't know." "No, probably not. But it doesn't matter, because you didn't leave it in the bathroom, Linda." "Do you know why I know you didn't leave your bracelet in the bathroom?" "Because you left it on the beach yesterday. You and Regina Rosen had yourselves a bunch of sun and a bucket full of margaritas, and you got so relaxed you kind of forgot you had a daughter and dozed off. And then when you woke up and realized you were going to be an hour late to pick her up from day camp..." "I was not an hour late." "You left in a panic. You forgot the suntan lotion, and you forgot your towel, and you forgot your bracelet, too. And now..." "And I wasn't drunk either, if that's what you're implying." "I don't drive our daughter drunk, Chris. That's your specialty." "And now you're pulling your usual and making it someone else's fault." The brat was hardly aware she was moving, wandering into the dim front hall and toward her parents' bedroom. The door was open about half a foot, revealing a slice of her parents' bed and the suitcase lying on top of it. Clothes had been pulled out and scattered across the floor. The brat knew that her mother had, in a spasm of strong feeling, started yanking things out and throwing them, looking for the lost bracelet. A golden hoop with a butterfly mounted upon it, made from glittering blue sapphires and ice-chip diamonds. Her mother paced back and forth, so every few seconds she flicked into view, passing through the sliver that the brat could see of the bedroom. "This has nothing to do with yesterday. I told you I didn't lose it at the beach. I didn't. It was next to the sink this morning, right beside my earrings. If they don't have it at the front desk, then one of the maids took it. That's what they do, the way they supplement their incomes. They help themselves to whatever the summer people leave around." The brat's father was silent for a while, and then he said, "What an ugly person you are inside. And I had a kid with you." The brat flinched. A prickling heat rose to the backs of her eyes, but she did not cry. Her teeth automatically went to her lip, sinking deep into it, producing a sharp twinge of pain that kept the tears at bay. Her mother showed no such restraint and began to weep. She wandered into sight again, one hand pressed over her face, her shoulders hitching. The brat didn't want to be seen and retreated down the hallway. She continued past her room, along the corridor, and out the front door. The thought of remaining indoors was suddenly intolerable. The air in the house was stale. The air conditioner had been off for a week. All the plants were dead and smelled it.
We've just heard NOS 4A2 by Joe Hill. And now, on to the master, Stephen King, a writer who once called himself the literary equivalent of a Big Mac with fries. Duma Key, one of his many classics, is the fascinating story of Fremantle, a man who discovers an incredible talent for painting after a freak accident where he loses his arm. In search of a new life, he moves to Duma Key, off Florida's west coast, a spit of land owned by a patroness of the arts, whose twin sisters went missing in the 1920s. Here, Fremantle is inspired to paint, but soon the paintings become predictive, even dangerous. Fremantle knows the only way forward is to discover what happened to the strange old woman's twin sisters. John Slattery narrates.
"The right side of my skull only cracked. The left side was slammed so hard against the ram's doorpost that it fractured in three places. Or maybe it was five. My memory is better than it used to be, but it's still a long way from what it once was. The doctors called what happened to my head a contra coup injury. And that kind of thing often does more damage than the original hit. My ribs were broken. My right hip was shattered. And although I retained 70% of the sight in my right eye, more on a good day, I lost my right arm. I was supposed to lose my life, but didn't. I was supposed to be mentally impaired thanks to the contra coup thing, And at first I was, but it passed. Sort of. By the time it did, my wife had gone. And not just sort of. We were married for 25 years, but you know what they say. It happens. I guess it doesn't matter. Gone is gone, and over is over. Sometimes that's a good thing. When I say I was mentally impaired, I mean that at first I didn't know who people were, even my wife, or what had happened. I couldn't understand why I was in such pain. I can't remember the quality of that pain now, 4 years later. I know that I suffered it, and that it was excruciating, but it's all pretty academic. It wasn't academic at the time. At the time, it was like being in hell and not knowing why you were there. At first, you were afraid you'd die. Then you were afraid you wouldn't. That's what Wireman says. And he would have known. He had his own season in hell. Everything hurt all the time. I had a constant ringing headache. Behind my forehead, it was always midnight in the world's biggest clock shop. Because my right eye was up, I was seeing the world through a film of blood, and I hardly knew what the world was. Nothing had a name. I remember one day when Pam was in the room, I was still in the hospital, and she was standing by my bed. I was extremely pissed that she should be standing when there was a thing to sit on right over in the cornhole. "Bring the friend," I said. "Sit in the friend." "What do you mean, Edgar?" she asked. "The friend, the buddy." My head was killing me and she was starting to cry. I hated her for that. She had no business crying, because she wasn't the one in the cage looking at everything through a red blur. She wasn't the monkey in the cage. And then it came to me. "Bring over the chum and sit down." When I grew stronger, I tried to hit people. Twice I tried to stab Pam, and on one of those two occasions I succeeded, although only with a plastic knife. She still needed a couple of stitches in her forearm. There were times when I had to be tied down. Here is what I remember most clearly about that part of my other life. A hot afternoon toward the end of my month-long stay in an expensive convalescent home, the expensive air conditioning broken, tied down in my bed, a soap opera on the television, 1,000 midnight bells ringing in my head, pain burning and stiffening my right side like a poker, my missing right arm itching, my missing right fingers twitching, no more OxyContin due for a while. I don't know how long because telling time is beyond me. And a nurse swims out of the red, a creature coming to look at the monkey in the cage, and the nurse says, "Are you ready to visit with your wife?" And I say, "Only if she brought a gun to shoot me with." You don't think that kind of pain will pass, but it does. Then they ship you home and replace it with the agony of physical rehabilitation. The red began to drain from my vision. A psychologist who specialized in hypnotherapy showed me some neat tricks for managing the phantom aches and itches in my missing arm. That was Cayman. It was Cayman who brought me Reba, one of the few things I took with me when I limped out of my other life and into the one I lived on Duma Key.
We've just heard Stephen King's Duma Key. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Joyce Carol Oates was born in Lockport in rural upstate New York in 1938. She grew up on her family's farm and attended the same one-room schoolhouse that her mother had studied in. Though Oates' hometown was hard hit by the Great Depression, she enjoyed the natural environment of the farm. Oates displayed a precocious interest in books and writing from an early age. Although her parents and grandparents had little education, they encouraged her and presented her with her first typewriter at age 14. An excellent student, Oates won a scholarship to Syracuse University, where she majored in English. At 19, she won a college short story contest sponsored by Mademoiselle magazine. She was class Victorian and went on to earn her master's in a single year at the University of Wisconsin. While at the university, she met Raymond Smith, who would become her husband after a three-month courtship. In 1962, Oates began teaching at the University of Detroit. Her first novel, With Shuddering Fall, was published when she was 28. Her novel, Them, received the National Book Award. In 1968, Oates moved to the University of Windsor in Ontario. Over the next 10 years, while teaching full-time, she published new books at the rate of two or three per year. And she and her husband started a small press and published the literary magazine, The Ontario Review. They moved to Princeton in 1978, where Oates still teaches creative writing as a distinguished professor of humanities. She's mentored numerous young writers, including Jonathan Safran Foer. Oates has written 39 novels, numerous short stories, volumes of poetry, plays, essays, and book reviews. In 1996, she received the Penn Malamud Award for a lifetime of literary achievement. Her novels Blackwater, What I Lived For, and Blonde were nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. In 2008, her husband died and Oates suffered severe depression. But the following year, she married Princeton professor Charles Gross. Today, we'll speak to her about her new book, The Accursed. To quote Stephen King's New York Times review, Joyce Carol Oates has written what may be the world's first postmodern gothic novel, E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime, set in Dracula's castle. It's dense, challenging, problematic, horrifying, funny, prolix, and full of crazy people. You should read it. I wish I could tell you more. Welcome, Joyce. It's an honor to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
You began working on The Accursed in 1984, then set it aside for nearly 30 years. What made you return to it?
Well, I had actually gone back every few years to reread the manuscript and to do a little revision and taking notes. Because it is a historical novel, I kept adding notes and, you know, new ideas and so forth. So it was really like an ongoing process, but I didn't have what I felt was a satisfactory voice for the narrative, for the narrator. And so it was actually all those years. And then in 2011, I decided that I would just rewrite it. And I changed the title and rewrote every word of it and subtracted quite a bit and added some things. Sort of a typical process of revision, except it took many years.
And the story is introduced by M.W. Van Dyke II, an amateur historian. Talk about your decision to begin the novel in this way.
Well, it always was an amateur historian who lived in Princeton and who was contemporaneous with the events of the novel, though he was very young at the time. It is not uncommon for Gothic novels and long novels of that type to have what we call frame. You know, a story told by somebody else, like Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, or Wuthering Heights has a frame. It's to distance the writer, myself, from the material to have a character who's also telling the story.
I see. So introduce us to The Crosswicks Curse.
It's a sort of mystery novel. Mysterious things are happening in this affluent village of Princeton, New Jersey in 1905-06, and there is actually a curse, and we find out through the course of a number of chapters of exploration and analysis and contemplation, we find out that the curse has something to do with white entitlement, white racism, bad behavior towards African Americans, and it has something to do also with suppression or repression, sexual repression, and general repression of new ideas, women's suffrage, and new ideas having to do with Darwinian evolutionary theory. So it's basically a novel, I think, about the conflict between the generations. One is the old world, the 19th century world, and the other is the new 20th century world that's struggling to be born.
In the novel, you have Woodrow Wilson, Grover Cleveland, Jack London Upton Sinclair. In The Accursed, were these characterizations based on fact? For example, Woodrow Wilson, you write him as a deeply paranoid university administrator and obsessive hypochondriac.
He was very much a hypochondriac. Oh, we know this from the biographies and even some of his letters. I read many of his letters. There is a big collection of Woodrow Wilson material at Princeton University, of course. And as for his paranoia, he was very much involved with exactly the same academic issue that's in the novel. There are other things about him. I mean, I present him as an intellectual person, and he's a very ardent Christian. He has a sense of mission about Christianity. And I mean, not everything about him is critical. I mean, I'm not critical of him completely. Some people would find his Christianity admirable. He was a bit of a sexist, or maybe more than a bit. He didn't think that women should vote and women should not have many rights at all. And he didn't think that Negroes, as they would call them, were fully human beings. I think he liked his Negro servants, and he was affectionate with them, given from the South. But I don't think he ever really thought that an African-American was a full human being the way he thought of himself.
Hmm. In the book, the setting of Princeton is a character in your story. Have settings always been so central to your novels?
Settings, yes. Many novels. I have a novel called The Falls, in which Niagara Falls is definitely a character and probably the most powerful character in the novel. I have a novel called Them, which is set in Detroit, Michigan, and leads up to the time of the Detroit riot in 1967. And in that case, the city is very much a character. However, the curse is unusual in that the very geography, the streets, the roads, the country houses, the big estates, the university buildings, the seminary, and so forth. There's a map. I did a map from the novel. It's unusual in that this sort of geographical reality is so powerful and so central to the novel. That is quite unusual.
Speaking about your body of work, if someone has not yet read one of your novels, would there be one or two you'd direct them to first?
It definitely depends upon what people like. Some people do like long novels, in which case I have a long novel called Blonde, which is about Norma Jean Baker, who becomes Marilyn Monroe. Basically, the novel is a fictitious biography of Norma Jean Baker, and she becomes this famous person called Marilyn Monroe. So if a person likes a long novel, that's quite long. Or if somebody likes short novels, I have novellas. I have a novella called Rape, a Love Story. That's only like 120 pages long. Then I have collections of short stories, and I have short novels, and I have a novel like The Accursed, which is sort of a mystery, gothic, postmodernist novel, really about American culture. So it depends upon a person's taste, what to begin with.
All right. Well, in the 1990s and early 2000s, you wrote several books, mostly mysteries, under pen names Rosamund Smith and Lauren Kelly. What made you do this?
Well, I wanted to start a different line of writing. I wanted to have novels that were fairly short, and they were cinematic, and they were what we call psychological thrillers. They're mystery novels with a sort of psychological dimension. They're not thrillers in the sense that they're about politics or about, you know, murderers and assassins. It's not political thrillers, but psychological thrillers. So I just wanted to start a different line of writing that I would write when I was not writing one of my long novels under the name Oates.
I understand you'll be retiring from full-time teaching in the near future. What's ahead for you after that?
Well, just to stay in that house and probably might teach at Princeton. After people retire from full-time teaching, they sometimes teach one course, like freshman seminar or writing workshop. I mean, I might even teach at Princeton again.
Mm-hmm.
I would not be a full-time faculty member. And then I'm going to be teaching at NYU in a graduate writing program. But we'll keep the same house. My husband and I like the house, and we have wonderful friends.
All right. And what book are you working on next?
I'm working on a novel that's a short novel. It's based on, it's not literally about, but it's based on the Tawana Brawley case. I'm writing a novel that is somewhat similar to that case, but not literally, because I never do that. I basically take an idea, I take something from history and make it more symbolic, and I drop out specific things and add other things. I sort of take ideas that seem representative of some interesting or even exciting or notorious theme in American culture. The Tawana Brawley case was extremely controversial. It was never satisfactorily resolved. And I like to write about cases that are not solved. So that's what I'm working on. That's called The Sacrifice.
Ah, all right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye. And now let's listen to a sample of The Accursed, performed by Grover Gardner.
An event enters history when it is recorded, but there may be multiple and competing histories, as there are multiple and competing eyewitness accounts. In this chronicle of the mysterious, seemingly linked events occurring in and in the vicinity of Princeton, New Jersey, in the approximate years 1900 to 1910, histories have been condensed to a single history, as a decade in time has been condensed, for purposes of aesthetic unity, to a period of approximately 14 months in 1905 to 1906. I know that a historian should be objective, but I am so passionately involved in this chronicle, and so eager to expose to a new century of readers some of the revelations regarding a tragic sequence of events occurring in the early years of the 20th century in central New Jersey, it is very difficult for me to retain a calm, let alone a scholarly tone. I have long been dismayed by the shoddy histories that have been written about this era in Princeton. For instance, Q.T. Hollinger's The Unsolved Enigma of the Crosswicks Curse, A Fresh Inquiry, 1949, a compendium of truths, half-truths, and outright falsehoods published by a local amateur historian in an effort to correct the most obvious errors of previous historians, Tight, Birdsey, Worthing, and Croft Crook, and the one-time bestseller The Vampire Murders of Old Princeton, 1938, by an anonymous author, believed to be a resident of the West End of Princeton, a notorious exploitive effort that dwells upon the superficial, sensational aspects of the curse, at the expense of the more subtle and less evident, i.e., the psychological, moral, and spiritual. I am embarrassed to state here so bluntly at the very start of my chronicle my particular qualifications for taking on this challenging project. So I will mention only that, like several key individuals in this chronicle, I am a graduate of Princeton University, class of 1927. I have long been a native Princetonian, born in February 1906, and baptized in the First Presbyterian Church of Princeton. I am descended from two of the oldest Princeton families, the Strands and the Van Dykes. My family residence was that austere old French Normandy stone mansion at 87 Hodge Road, now owned by strangers with a name ending in Stein, who, it is said, have barbarously gutted the interior of the house and renovated it in a more modern style. I apologize for this intercalation. It is not so much an emotional as it is an aesthetic and moral outburst I promise will not happen again. Thus, though a very young child in the aftermath of the accursed era, I passed my adolescence in Princeton at a time when the tragic mysteries were often talked of in wonderment and dread, and when the forced resignation of Woodrow Wilson from the presidency of Princeton University in 1910 was still a matter of both regret and malicious mirth in the community. Through these connections and others, I have been privy to many materials unavailable to other historians, like the shocking secret coded journal of the invalid Mrs. Adelaide McLean Burr, And the intimate, and also rather shocking, personal letters of Woodrow Wilson to his beloved wife Ellen, as well as the hallucinatory ravings of the accursed grandchildren of Winslow Slade. Todd Slade was an older classmate of mine at the Princeton Academy, whom I knew only at a distance. Also, I have had access to many other personal documents, letters, diaries, journals, never available to outsiders. In addition, I have had the privilege of consulting the manuscripts and special collections of Firestone Library at Princeton University, though I can't boast of having waded through the legendary 5 tons of research materials, like Woodrow Wilson's early biographer, Ray Stannard Baker. I am sure that I've closely perused at least a full ton. I hope it doesn't sound boastful to claim that, of all persons living, now, no one is possessed of as much information as I am concerning the private as well as the public nature of the curse.
That was The Accursed by Joyce Carol Oates. Dean Koontz is a favorite name in this genre. Let's check in with his Odd Thomas series, Deeply Odd, Book 6. Odd Thomas finds himself on the wrong end of the barrel as a truck driver, decked out like a rhinestone cowboy, pulls a gun on him. Though he narrowly dodges a bullet, Odd can't outrun the shocking vision burned into his mind, or the destiny that drives him into a harrowing showdown with absolute evil. How do you make sure a crime that hasn't happened yet never does? That's the critical question facing Odd Thomas, the young man with unique ability to commune with restless spirits and help them find justice and peace. But this time, it's the living who desperately need Odd on their side. 3 helpless innocents will be brutally executed unless Odd intervenes. But who the potential victims are and where they can be found remain a mystery. The only thing Odd knows for sure is who the killer will be, the homicidal stranger who tried to shoot him dead. David Aaron Baker narrates.
Before dawn, I woke in darkness to the ringing of a tiny bell, the thimble-sized bell that I wore on a chain around my neck. 3 bursts of silvery sound, a brief silence after each. I was lying on my back in bed, utterly motionless, yet the bell rang 3 times again. The vibrations that shivered through my bare chest seemed much too strong to have been produced by such a tiny clapper. A 3rd set of 3 rings followed, and then only silence. I waited and wondered until dawn crept down the sky and across the bedroom windows. Later that morning in early March, when I walked downtown to buy blue jeans and a few pairs of socks, I met a guy who had a .45 pistol and a desire to commit a few murders. From that encounter, the day grew uglier as surely as the sun moved from east to west. My name is Odd Thomas. I have accepted my oddness. I am no longer surprised that I am drawn to trouble as reliably as iron to a magnet. 19 months ago, when I was 20, I should have been riddled with bullets in that big news shopping mall shootout in Pico Mundo, a desert town in California. They say I saved lots of people in my hometown, yet many died. I didn't. I have to live with that. Stormy Llewellyn, the girl I loved more than life itself, was one of those who died that day. I saved others, but I couldn't save her. I have to live with that, too. Living is the price I pay for failing her, a high price that must be paid every morning that I wake. In the 19 months since that day of death, I've traveled in search of the meaning of my life. I learn by going where I have to go. Currently, I rented a quaint, furnished 3-bedroom cottage in a quiet coastal town a couple of 100 miles from Pico Mundo. The front porch faced the sea, and yellow bougainvillea cascaded across half the roof. Anna Maria, whom I'd known only since late January, occupied one of the bedrooms. She appeared to be ready to give birth in about a month, but she claimed that she'd been pregnant for a long time and insisted that she would be pregnant longer still. Although she said many things that I failed to understand, I believe that she always spoke the truth. She was mysterious, but not deceptive. We were friends, never paramours. A lover who is enigmatic will most likely prove to be a cataclysm waiting to happen. but a charming friend whose usual warmth is raveled through with moments of cool inscrutability can be an intriguing companion. The morning when I set out on a shopping expedition, Anna Maria followed me as far as the porch. She said, "Daylight savings time doesn't start for another 5 days." At the bottom of the steps, I turned to look at her. She wasn't a beauty, but she wasn't plain either. Her clear, pale skin appeared to be as smooth as soap, and her large, dark eyes, which reflected the sparkling sea, seemed as deep as galaxies. In sneakers, gray khaki pants, and a baggy sweater, she was so petite that she might have been a child dressed in her father's clothes. Not sure why she had mentioned daylight savings time, I said, "I won't be long. I'll be back hours before sunset." "Darkness doesn't fall to a predictable schedule. Darkness can overwhelm you any time of the day, as you know too well." She once told me that there are people who want to kill her. Although she had said no more and had not identified her would-be murderers, I believe that she was as truthful about this as about all other things. "I'll stay here if you're in danger."
"You're the one in danger, young man. Here or there, anywhere, you're the one perpetually on the cliff's edge."
She was 18, and I was nearly 22, but when she called me young man, it always felt right. She possessed an air of timelessness, as if she might have lived in any century of recorded history, or in all of them.
"Do what you must," she said, "but come back to us."
"Do what you must" sounded ominously significant, not the language one might use to send a friend off to buy socks. From behind Anna Maria and beyond a window, Tim watched solemnly.
We've just heard Deeply Odd, Odd Thomas, Book 6 by Dean Kunst. Stephen King has called Christopher Smith a cultural genius. You Only Die Twice is Smith's most controversial novel. In her past, Cheryl Dunning died once. A violent act killed her, but heroics brought her back. Now, if she can't save herself from two killers hunting her in the Maine woods, she's about to die again, this time at the hands of two men armed with a Bible, guns, and a twisted interpretation of the word of the Lord. Fueled by their righteous fury, they are determined to find Cheryl and murder her for what they perceive as her life's worth of sins. What they don't know is that Cheryl is a maniac, a Maine girl, right down to her core. She knows how to use the woods in ways that might, if she's lucky, turn one man against another. R.C. Bray narrates.
At first, all she was aware of was a cold wetness against her cheek and explosions of light along the periphery of her vision. She could hear someone talking to her, a man, but she couldn't understand what he was saying. She felt her body being jolted, kicked, punched. Her head hurt. There was blood in her mouth, and something else, something thick and round, which made it difficult for her to breathe. Her left leg began to twitch. The flashes of light continued until the pain in her head became too much for her to bear. Something was shoved into her right hand. She felt her fingers being closed around it, and then, somehow, the object was attached to her hand. She wondered what it was. She wondered where she was. Had she died again? Or was she about to die again? She knew all about death. She faced it before, and she fell deep into its hole. Was she here again? She passed out and went into a light of her own. Chapter 2. When she woke again, Cheryl Dunning blinked, and though her head was still thick and her eyesight still cloudy, she was able to process that the darkness she now saw had nothing to do with death or being unconscious, but everything to do with the fact that it was night. She was outside and she was alive, but where was she? How did she get here? She tried to make sense of it, tried to remember what events led her to this, but she couldn't remember anything. Her mind was blank. She needed to leave, get home. But where was home? She tried to raise her head, but the effort was excruciating, and she realized that she couldn't. She put her left hand beneath her breast and tried to push herself up, but she cried out in pain and slumped back onto the ground. She wasn't able to move, at least not now. Instinct kicked in. The part of her that could still reason realized that she might have broken a bone, or worse, several bones. She needed to be careful. It felt as if someone had pummeled her. As she lay there, it came to her that she was on a moist forest floor. She could smell damp timber, the rot of whatever lay beneath her, and she was aware that it was raining. Water tapped against the side of her cheek and soaked her clothes. It wasn't a heavy rain, but it was steady, and she was alert enough to know that her situation was dire. She was alone and exposed to the elements in some unknown woods. Her thoughts turned to the wild animals she knew were around her, circling her, smelling her, wanting to tear her apart and eat her. The fear she felt at that moment made her want to get up and run, but her body wasn't having it. Something was wrong with her head. It wouldn't stop throbbing. She felt as if it had been kicked. And so she lay there, a prisoner to whatever had happened to her. She listened to the night and occasionally heard rustling sounds in the woods. What would prey on her tonight? Something would. She felt utterly without hope and knew that she'd be dead before she had the chance to help herself. She closed her eyes. She tried to remember her life, but there was no life to remember. It was as if someone had erased it from her mind and left in its place a pain she had never before experienced. It consumed her before, and it did so again. She wavered on the precipice of that pain, and then she gave herself over to it and slipped into unconsciousness.
That was You Only Die Twice by Christopher Smith. The Third Gate by Lincoln Child takes readers to one of the Earth's most forbidding places, the Sud in northern Sudan, where characters face arduous conditions and perhaps a curse. Under the direction of famed explorer Porter Stone, an archaeological team believes they found the burial chamber of King Narmer, the near-mythical god-king who united Upper and Lower Egypt in 3200 BC. The archaeologist believes the greatest prize of all, Narmer's crown, might be buried with him. The crown of two Egypts is the stuff of legends, purported to possess amazing powers. Amid the tangle of mud and dead vegetation, a series of harrowing and inexplicable occurrences are wreaking havoc. With a monumental discovery within reach, Professor Jeremy Logan is brought in to investigate. What he finds raises new questions and alarm. Jonathan McLean narrates.
Growing up in Westport, currently teaching at Yale, Jeremy Logan thought himself familiar with his home state of Connecticut. But the stretch through which he now drove was a revelation. Heading east from Groton, following the emailed directions, he'd turned onto US 1 and then, just past Stonington, onto US 1 alternate. Hugging the gray Atlantic coastline, he'd passed Wequetequock, rolled over a bridge that looked as old as New England itself, then turned sharply right onto a well-paved but unmarked road. Quite abruptly, the mini-malls and tourist motels fell away behind. He passed a sleepy cove in which lobster boats bobbed at anchor and then entered an equally sleepy hamlet. And yet it was a real village, a working village, with a general store and a tackle shop and an Episcopal church with a steeple three sizes too large, and gray shingled houses with trim picket fences painted white. There were no hulking SUVs, no out-of-state plates, and the scattering of people sitting on benches or leaning out of front windows waved to him as he passed. The April sunlight was strong, and the sea air had a clean, fresh bite to it. A signboard hanging from the doorframe of the post office informed him he was in Pevensey Point, population 182. Something about the place reminded him irresistibly of Herman Melville. "Karen," he said, "if you'd seen this place, you'd never have made us buy that summer cottage in Hyannis." Although his wife had died of cancer years ago, Logan still allowed himself to converse with her now and then. Of course, it was usually, though not always, more monologue than conversation. At first, he'd been sure to do it only when he was certain not to be overheard. But then, as what had started as a kind of intellectual hobby for him turned increasingly into a profession, he no longer bothered to be so discreet. These days, judging by what he did for a living, people expected him to be a little strange. 2 miles beyond the town, precisely as the directions indicated, a narrow lane led off to the right. Taking it, Logan found himself in a sandy forest of thin scrub pine that soon gave way to tawny dunes. The dunes ended at a metal bridge leading to a low, broad island jutting out into Fisher's Island Sound. Even from this distance, Logan could see there were at least a dozen structures on the island, all built of the same reddish-brown stone. At the center were 3 large 5-story buildings that resembled dormitories, arranged in parallel, like dominoes. At the far end of the island, partly concealed by the various structures, was an empty airstrip, and beyond everything lay the ocean and the dark green line of Rhode Island. Logan drove the final mile, stopping at a gatehouse before the bridge. He showed the printed email to the guard inside, who smiled and waved him through. A single sign beside the gatehouse, expensive-looking but unobtrusive, read simply, CTS. He crossed the bridge, passed an outlying structure, and pulled into a parking lot. It was surprisingly large. There were at least 100 cars and space for as many more. Nosing into one of the spots, he killed the engine. But instead of exiting, he paused to read the email once again. Jeremy, I'm pleased and relieved to hear of your acceptance. I also appreciate your being flexible, since, as I mentioned earlier, there's no way yet to know how long your investigation will take. In any case, you'll receive a minimum of 2 weeks' compensation at the rate you specified. I'm sorry I can't give you more details at this point, but you're probably used to that. And I have to tell you, I can't wait to see you again after all this time. Directions to the center are below. I'll be waiting for you on the morning of the 18th. Any time between 10 and noon will be fine. One other thing. Once you're on board with the project, you might find it hard to get calls out with any degree of certainty. So please be sure you've cleared your decks before you arrive. Looking forward to the 18th. Best, ER. Logan glanced at his watch. 11:30. He turned the note over once in his hands. You might find it hard to get calls out with any degree of certainty. Why was that? Perhaps cell phone towers had never made it beyond picturesque Pevensey Point? Nevertheless, what the email said was true. He was used to that. He pulled a duffel bag from the passenger seat, slipped the note into it, and got out of the car.
That was The Third Gate by Lincoln Child. Late one night, exploring her father's library, a young woman finds an ancient book and a cache of yellowing letters. The letters are all addressed to "My dear and unfortunate successor," and they plunge the woman into a world she never dreamed of, a labyrinth where the secrets of her parents' past connect to an inconceivable evil hidden in the depths of history. In Elizabeth Kostova's The Historian, the letters provide links to one of the darkest powers humanity has ever known. It is a quest for truth about Vlad the Impaler, the medieval ruler whose barbarous reign formed the basis of the legend of Dracula. Generations of historians have risked their reputations, their sanity, even their lives to learn the truth. Now, one young woman must decide whether to take up this quest, to follow her father in a hunt that nearly brought him to ruin years ago. What does the legend of Vlad the Impaler have to do with the modern world? The answer crosses time and borders, as first the father and then the daughter search for clues. An ensemble cast performs the book.
My father's library had probably once been a sitting room, but he sat down only to read, and he considered a large library more important than a large living room. He had long since given me free run of his collection. During his absences, I spent hours doing my homework at the mahogany desk or browsing the shelves that lined every wall. I understood later that my father had either half forgotten what was on one of the top shelves or, more likely, assumed I would never be able to reach it. Late one night, I took down not only a translation of the Kama Sutra, but also a much older volume and an envelope of yellowing papers. I can't say even now what made me pull them down. But the image I saw at the center of the book, the smell of age that rose from it, and my discovery that the papers were personal letters, all caught my attention forcibly. I knew I shouldn't examine my father's private papers, or anyone's, and I was also afraid that Mrs. Clay might suddenly come in to dust the dustless desk. That must have been what made me look over my shoulder at the door. But I couldn't help reading the first paragraph of the topmost letter, holding it for a couple of minutes as I stood near the shelves.
December 12, 1930. Trinity College, Oxford. My dear and unfortunate successor, it is with regret that I imagine you, whoever you are, reading the account I must put down here. The regret is partly for myself, because I will surely be at least in trouble, maybe dead, or perhaps worse, if this is in your hands. But my regret is also for you, my yet unknown friend, because only by someone who needs such vile information will this letter someday be read. If you are not my successor in some other sense, you will soon be my heir. And I feel sorrow at bequeathing to another human being my own perhaps unbelievable experience of evil. Why I myself inherited it, I don't know. But I hope to discover that fact eventually. Perhaps in the course of writing to you, or perhaps in the course of further events.
At this point, my sense of guilt, and something else, too, made me put the letter hastily back in its envelope. But I thought about it all that day and all the next. When my father returned from his latest trip, I looked for an opportunity to ask him about the letters in the strange book. I waited for him to be free, for us to be alone, but he was very busy in those days, and something about what I had found made me hesitate to approach him. Finally, I asked him to take me on his next trip. It was the first time I had kept a secret from him, and the first time I had ever insisted on anything. Reluctantly, my father agreed. He talked with my teachers and with Mrs. Clay, and reminded me that there would be ample time for my homework while he was in meetings. I wasn't surprised. For a diplomat's child, there was always waiting to be done. I packed my Navy suitcase, taking my school books and too many pairs of clean knee socks. Instead of leaving the house for school that morning, I departed with my father, walking silently and gladly beside him toward the station. A train carried us to Vienna. My father hated planes, which he said took the travel out of traveling. There we spent one short night in a hotel. Another train took us through the Alps, past all the white and blue heights of our map at home. Outside a dusty yellow station, my father started up our rented car, and I held my breath until we turned in at the gates of a city he'd described to me so many times that I could already see it in my dreams. Autumn comes early to the foot of the Slovenian Alps. Even before September, the abundant harvests are followed by a sudden poignant rain that lasts for days and brings down leaves in the lanes of the villages. Now, in my 50s, I find myself wandering that direction every few years, reliving my first glimpse of the Slovenian countryside. This is old country. Every autumn mellows it a little more in aeternum, each beginning with the same three colors, a green landscape, two or three yellow leaves falling through a gray afternoon. I suppose the Romans, who left their walls here and their gargantuan arenas to the west on the coast, saw the same autumn and gave the same shiver. When my father's car swung through the gates of the oldest of Julian cities, I hugged myself. For the first time, I'd been struck by the excitement of the traveler who looks history in her subtle face.
We've just heard The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. Book Report brings you one of the greatest thrillers ever written, Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White. It was a phenomenal bestseller in the 1860s, achieving even greater success than works by Charles Dickens. The story begins with an eerie midnight encounter between artist Walter Hartwright and a ghostly woman dressed in white who seems desperate to share a secret. The next day, Hartwright, engaged as a drawing master to the beautiful Laura Fairley and her half-sister, tells his pupils about the strange events of the previous evening. Determined to learn all they can about the mysterious woman, the three soon find themselves drawn into a chilling vortex of crime, poison, kidnapping, and international intrigue. Josephine Bailey and Simon Preble narrate.
My father was a drawing master before me. His exertions had made him highly successful in his profession, and his affectionate anxiety to provide for the future of those who were dependent on his labours had impelled him, from the time of his marriage, to devote to the ensuring of his life a much larger portion of his income than most men consider it necessary to set aside for that purpose. Thanks to his admirable prudence and self-denial, my mother and sister were left, after his death, as independent of the world as they had been during his lifetime. I succeeded to his connection, and had every reason to feel grateful for the prospect that awaited me at the starting of my life. The quiet twilight was still trembling on the topmost ridges of the heath, and the view of London below me had sunk into a black gulf in the shadow of the cloudy night, when I stood before the gate of my mother's cottage. I'd hardly rung the bell before the house door was opened violently. My worthy Italian friend, Professor Pesca, appeared in the servant's place and darted out joyously to receive me with a shrill foreign parody on an English cheer. On his own account, and I must be allowed to add on mine also, the professor merits the honour of a formal introduction. Accident has made him the starting point of the strange family story which it is the purpose of these pages to unfold. I had first become acquainted with my Italian friend by meeting him at certain great houses where he taught his own language and I taught drawing. All I then knew of the history of his life was that he had once held a situation in the University of Padua, that he had left Italy for political reasons, the nature of which he uniformly declined to mention to anyone, and that he had been for many years respectably established in London as a teacher of languages. Without actually being a dwarf, for he was perfectly well proportioned from head to foot, Pesca was, I think, the smallest human being I ever saw out of a showroom. Remarkable anywhere by his personal appearance, he was still further distinguished among the rank and file of mankind by the harmless eccentricity of his character. The ruling idea of his life appeared to be that he was bound to show his gratitude to the country which had afforded him an asylum and a means of subsistence by doing his utmost to turn himself into an Englishman. Not content with paying the nation in general the compliment of invariably carrying an umbrella and invariably wearing gaiters and a white hat, the professor further aspired to become an Englishman in his habits and amusements, as well as in his personal appearance. Finding us distinguished as a nation by our love of athletic exercise, the little man, in the innocence of his heart, devoted himself impromptu to all our English sports and pastimes whenever he had the opportunity of joining them. Firmly persuaded that he could adopt our national amusements of the field by an effort of will, precisely as he had adopted our national gaiters and our national white hat. I had seen him risk his limbs blindly at a fox hunt and in a cricket field, and soon afterwards I saw him risk his life just as blindly in the sea at Brighton. We had met there accidentally and were bathing together. If we'd been engaged in any exercise peculiar to my own nation, I should, of course, have looked after Pesca carefully. But as foreigners are generally quite as well able to take care of themselves in the water as Englishmen, it never occurred to me that the art of swimming might merely add one more to the list of manly exercises which the professor believed that he could learn impromptu. Soon after we had both struck out from shore, I stopped, finding my friend did not gain on me, and turned round to look for him.
That was The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. Readers, the depth and breadth, indeed the history of this genre, is amazing and really so worthy of your time. For more titles from across the spectrum, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.